I'm Peter Medlin. You are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, good news, it's a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast is nominated by our audience. We want you to be a part of this show with us. So please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And today on the show, it is Cynthia Taines. She's an associate professor at Northern Illinois University in the College of Education who specializes in the sociology of education and education policy. And she's got a new book out called The Metropolitan Community, Partnering for Equality Across the Educational Divide. Picture this for me. Two public high schools, 25 minutes apart. One is a wealthy suburban district and the other is an urban lower income school in Chicago. Geographically, very close, but worlds away when it comes to how much money the schools can spend on their students and the resources and services they can provide them. And Cynthia's project brought groups of students from each of those schools together where they saw for the first time the full disparity of how different their schools and educations were, and then teamed up to advocate for state policies to change how public education is funded in Illinois. One quick note up front, Cynthia does use pseudonyms for the school that were part of the project and the students who participated. It's a fascinating conversation, so let's just dive right into it. This is my conversation with NIU education professor Cynthia Taines, and we start out talking about how the book got its title, The Metropolitan Community, and her background as a teacher.
I have worked in some city schools before as like someone who supports teachers. I worked in Detroit when I was a graduate student, and it was a curriculum to have more hands-on science education, and we were introducing technology and we were asking students to go outside and test water quality. So it was a very engaging hands-on curriculum that we developed in collaboration with the teachers. And then when we were in Detroit on site, we found like it was much more difficult to implement a curriculum like that than we expected. It was hard to get the time and money to go outside and have a field trip, and it was difficult to have technology available to us.
Which is also a money thing.
Yes, and then also I remember one time there was a snowstorm and the city wasn't able to send plows out to all of the schools, and so the school was shut down for a number of more days than the snowstorm had lasted, and so that, you know, deprived kids of like those few days of education. And so that got me thinking about some of the limitations on city schools, even when there's so many people doing their best, like coming up with all this engaging curriculum and teaching, and like all the obstacles that could be in the way of actually delivering that, you know, to students and having them fully be able to engage with it. So that got me thinking. I also worked in Milwaukee Public Schools a little bit, also when I was a graduate student at UW-Madison. And that was part of my dissertation, where I worked with a community-based organization that got students interested in their schools, not just interested in their schools, but also involved in influencing some of the decision-making that happened in their school. So it was kind of a student activism community-based organization.
Oh, man. What kind of work were they doing at the school then?
All kinds of things. Like, some of them wanted to work on the school bathrooms and making those.
Food, I feel like, always
food,
comes up whenever
food,
we're talking
definitely.
About these conversations, getting student engagement. Yeah.
Sometimes it was dress code policy that students felt like was too strict.
For sure.
So there were all kinds of smaller projects that they were working on. And during that time, it was interesting because Milwaukee participates in a voluntary integration program where some students go to suburban schools for their education. They live in the same neighborhoods as other kids, but they voluntarily, their family signed them up to attend a suburban school instead. And so I also listened to students who were from the same neighborhoods and the same places, but they had a little bit of trouble relating to their educational experiences and coming up with some kind of common project because their educational experiences were so different. So those were like pieces that were in my mind. And then I also learned about the Milliken versus Bradley decision, which is a Supreme Court decision that basically said that suburban schools did not have to participate in school integration.
I was going to ask you about this because this is actually where the title of your book comes from,
exactly.
Right? It's from Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's dissent in that case.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about that and again, how that influences the book.
Yeah. I was really curious about the way he framed the decision and his dissent of this decision, because the decision itself said that suburban schools did not have to assist and collaborate with city school systems in order to promote the ideal of school integration. And what that did is sort of left cities on their own to try to figure out those social issues on their own. And Justice Marshall in his dissent said that we shouldn't think about these school districts as being these like self-contained islands. Instead, we should think about the broader community and how we can benefit the broader society. And, you know, in order to do that, there needs to be some kind of collaboration across school districts. And we need to kind of have a larger vision that he called the metropolitan community. So it's not just a city school system or a suburban school system or this district and that district, but instead we should think more regionally about this broader community and how we can uplift the community as a whole. And so that made me really curious. So I had all these like seeds in my mind, like thinking about the city school systems and what kinds of barriers were often placed on them. And then thinking about the difficulty, but also the interest that I had in city and suburban school students relating to each other. And so when I moved to Chicago, I just started thinking about like how could we create a vision like that? How could we bring city and suburban school systems together so that they would be in this broader community? Could we contribute to that broader metropolitan community vision? So that's where that vision started. And then I was thinking about how to actualize it. And I asked a teacher I'd gotten to know in Chicago if she could help me think through this as well. And so we started meeting, and then I met some suburban teachers through a class that I taught at NIU on a suburban schools campus and recruited a teacher there. And so we just kind of got together and started thinking about how would this program and project look? What would our vision be? And what would our process be for bringing students together in an authentic way?
And let's give some background to some context for it. How long ago was this, and kind of, you know, when did the project run?
Mm-hmm.
What's, you know, just like kind of the background information of how, because obviously I know that students could be a part of this project also for multiple school years, but like how long did it go for?
It went for about 10 years, actually, from around 2011 to 2020. And 2020 is sort of a crucial year because we all shut down. So we had like a number of years of this collaboration with different groups of students and different numbers of students who participated, and also in some cases different schools. So we had the schools that are at the heart of this book, Taylor High School, which is a Chicago public school, and Wyndham High School, which is a suburban school just north of Chicago. But in the history of the project, we also worked with at least one or two other Chicago public schools, as well as another suburban school, too.
I want to really quick, again, for people who have not read the book,
mm-hmm.
to just explain a little bit more about mm-hmm. kind of the framework that the book has, right?
Yeah.
Which is it's built on these two schools, as you mentioned, one urban school, one suburban school, about 25 minutes away from each other,
mm-hmm.
but worlds away when it comes to money and resources, and in ways that I think people expect, and maybe even the kids expected more when they started doing tours, where you're like, okay, yeah, one of them, the school might be a little bit newer or larger. Maybe they offer classes they didn't, but there are even some other aspects of that
mm-hmm.
that the students, you know, the things that you can't, mm-hmm. that you don't know about, you don't know you're missing.
Exactly.
But can you, let's just paint a broader picture about what these two schools look like and mm-hmm. how different they are.
Sure, yeah. So I'll start with the city school. So Taylor High School is in Chicago, and it's part of the public school system in that city. And it is in a lower income, predominantly Latino neighborhood. And as a neighborhood school, it doesn't have any selection criteria to get into that school. And
do you live here is the criteria,
exactly.
Right.
So you live close by. And Chicago does have some schools that are selective, so you have to test into them or apply to them in other ways. This is a neighborhood school with no criteria for entry. And it is a school that is a really tight community. It's a fairly small school. When we started the project, around 800 students went to that school, but it did start shrinking because enrollments have been declining in the city. So while we were doing the project, the enrollment did start to go down. The students are really dynamic and excited and really invested both in school and also in the project that they participated in. But they are, you know, facing a significant number of barriers due to the underfunding of that school. So some examples of that are that the librarian was only part-time, and so that meant that when the librarian wasn't on site, they had to close the doors and lock it, and so that meant that any of the books and computers and other resources that you would expect from a school library just weren't available to students. It also often meant that they didn't have a quiet space to go study during the day if the librarian was not on shift, and so that meant they are often doing homework in the cafeteria where it was noisy and a little harder to concentrate. There was also some limitations regarding college counseling, where the college counselor was part-time because they also not part-time counselor, but they also had many other duties, so that it wasn't only college counseling that they were focused on, and because of that it was hard to get a meeting with them and to get that kind of one-on-one support that especially first-generation college students might need in order to figure out what they were being asked to do on a college application. Mm-hmm. So those are some examples of the more limited resources at the city school. And of course, they had great teachers who tried to fill in some of those gaps and share information about college, for example. But there were students who often felt a little lost about that process. And then the suburban school, also a public school, also really a neighborhood school because you don't have to test into it, but is a really high income area. And so because of how our public school system works, really you need to have the financial resources in order to buy a house that's close to that school. And it was way more funded than the city school I was just describing. And it was a large school that combined students from many different towns. So it had about 3,000 students who attended. And very many resources. Really, like the students sort of talked about how they didn't even have time to use everything that was available to them.
Yes.
So there, some examples of that were sitting in a radio station booth, and they actually had a radio station, on their campus that we got to witness students doing a sports program, doing kind of the play-by-play, but it was a high school students who were leading the show, and there's an Olympic-sized pool. So those things...
They were snorkeling.
Yes. So those things really stand out, but I think you were referencing how students don't always notice some resources or wouldn't necessarily imagine those up front, and I think one of the things that the suburban school had going with it was just the number of people that worked there in all kinds of capacities. So there was an actual college counseling department, and so those counselors were only focused on college counseling, not all the other things that other counselors had to focus on. They had those counselors as well. They had, tech support, so to make sure that computers were working for instructors, but also, for the iPads that students were issued. And they have social workers and counselors, and they have a program for students who are ill and need to take some time away from school to help them catch up. And so
that really stood out to me when I was reading the book too, because there's a point in the book where one of the students, I believe, says that they broke their leg and they were out of school for a couple weeks, and that they, I believe they said, they had someone who came to their house to kind of like help tutor and help, you know, keep them up on their assignments. And then a very similar situation that had happened to a school or to a student at Taylor. And they were like, what? Like, they just gave me the packet when I got back, or whatever it might be.
Yeah. And so, like, there's just like more resources and supports to kind of like fill those gaps and help their reentry, you know, back into school and help them catch up. Yeah, so such disparate experiences, but as you mentioned, only 25 minutes away from each other, and so these are the two school communities where we're working on bringing together.
You know, and obviously, like, so many of us go to public schools, we all have school experiences, and I think that a lot of us, even if we don't understand the like specific intricacies of how, you know, property tax dollars influence, you know, school funding, we all kind of intuitively know that schools in wealthier towns and neighborhoods have more resources, right? Like, it is something that I think everyone understands, but we don't always have the experience that your students do of being able to make that concrete, being able to literally go there and be like, I had no idea this existed. And like I said about, like, you don't know the things that you don't know.
Right.
That, yeah, those are some of the things that stuck out to me was you mentioned the library. That students being like, I just, where if at their school, if the part-time librarian was out, the door was locked, that a part of, or at least a few students were like, I just thought that's how school libraries work. Because that's their only frame of reference. Like, why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And I think one student even says out loud, like, I wish I could steal this library. Right? Yes. They're so excited about it.
Yeah.
But between that and, like, the more of that kind of invisible stuff, like the school, the counseling for, you know, college preparation, where one school has, you know, maybe one school has like eight or nine, and just all the things that does. I'm trying to remember what else I made a note on when it comes to those things. But yeah, it like is far beyond just the like classes. And we mentioned like the snorkeling or glass blowing or whatever it else it might be. Nurses was one that stuck out to me too. It's even just like having a full-time nurse is something that, you know, I think a lot of people would take for granted. Why, of course, we've got a school nurse, but these are very different.
Right. No, not the case in Chicago public schools. A lot of times nurses actually have coverage of several schools.
Right.
And so they have short shifts at each school, but they have to travel around basically to different schools. And of course, the health center at the suburban school had a permanent full-time staff of four nurses, and it looked like a doctor's office, you know, so that was really surprising to some of our city students. And yes, of course, you might take that for granted if they always had a nurse around. And so, and that was something that the suburban students definitely pointed to, that they were surprised that wasn't like just a regular part of school. And so it was often like being there and having the direct experience just made such a big difference. This is sort of that idea of sort of experiential learning, like being in the environment, really feeling what it feels like, and seeing people trying hard with more limited resources, or seeing people, you know, go through their day without having to think where they are going to get the next thing that they need for school. It's really important, and it's a really, you know, distinct difference. I also think that being in the space with the students who go to that school, who can explain a little bit further, like, this is how I use this stuff, or this is what it means to me, or this is how I use the things that I have, but here's some of the things that I wish I had. That's also a really important part of the experience, that you're starting to hear a little bit more of sort of the emotional testimony of the people who have these different experiences. And I think that can make a deeper impact on students when they actually sort of feel and see what these differences are.
Yeah. And like, we've been talking about the tours that these students did. Can you take us back to some of the first tours that you had, whether it be the Wyndham kids going to Taylor for the first time, the Taylor kids going to Wyndham, about the vibe that comes? There's a very particular dynamic, I feel like, that starts coming up pretty soon after that starts to happen.
Yeah, so I think we normally have the suburban students come visit the city school. And before they do that, the city students sort of meet together and sort of think about, like, what is our school story? How do we want to share our school experiences? What do we want to say about what we love about our school? What do we want to say about what might be challenging in the school? And they come up basically with a whole kind of map of the school and where we're going to go. And they practice it. So they practice, like, how they're going to talk about each space. And then the suburban students come, we split up in small groups so that there can be conversation during these school tours. And they sit in on classes, and they go to gyms, and they peek in at the cafeteria. And so they're really able to get a sense of the whole space. And, you know, something that's interesting is that one of the things the suburban students notice is going to the art class and noticing how many students were present in the arts class. And arts is often a subject area that sometimes it's helpful to have more sort of one-on-one attention in a smaller class to allow your creativity to, like, you know, sort of fully bloom. And so the one student sort of noted that that's a pretty crowded classroom, and wondering how that might affect, you know, students' experience. And going to the college counseling office that we were just referencing, and noting that there isn't necessarily someone available all the time to assist with, you know, college applications. So they were definitely sort of registering and noticing some of the things. Part of what we'll probably talk about is sometimes they had a little difficulty communicating fully about what they were seeing, but they were definitely sort of noticing and feeling a sense of surprise about the resources that were and were not available in that city school. And then, of course, we also have the reverse when the suburban school and the city students go to the suburban school, and so they see, you know, all kinds of differences in the cafeteria. Like you mentioned, food is always present on teenagers' mind. And so
mine too, yeah.
And so seeing, like, the cafeteria and how it was sort of set up like a food court at a mall, so that you could get, like, a made-to-order smoothie and a made-to-order sandwich or stir-fry bowl. Like, that made a really big impression on the Chicago kids. Just, like, the sense of options, both in the cafeteria, but just in general, the sense of options about, like, what kinds of classes you could take beyond sort of your standard, you know, math, history, science, was really striking to them.
I thought there was a moment where you mentioned too that you were actually surprised that the students weren't more shocked about what they saw.
Yes. And that goes to, there's a section in the book that's sort of about their communication and what were some of the sticking points in their communication, because I was very surprised that as soon as you go into these schools, you can definitely see stark differences. But I was very surprised that it didn't seem to be verbalized, the shock and surprise, as much when they were in going on these tours, or even when we were doing the debriefs together with both schools.
Right. Were you doing one-on-one interviews with them later on, or in small groups?
Yes. So when I was doing the interviews one-on-one, or when I was just with students from one school, then the story became really different, and they did express some of that shock and surprise. So I was curious about why that was happening, like why it seemed so difficult to be upfront about these differences.
And this is direct, I think.
Yes,
is the word,
exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So I was curious about why that was happening, what could end up being the difference there. And part of it is I had some students, I think, going back to the earlier part of our conversation, who had been there longer, who'd been participating this longer, who felt more confident. And so when I was interviewing them, I was like, what is going on with this? I would actually just present, here's this challenge I'm trying to work through, I'm trying to understand. Yeah. And so what is going on here? And so I had students that I call kind of like navigators in the book who could kind of break it down for me.
Yeah.
And the suburban students said they felt very uncomfortable being upfront and sharing some of the advantages that they had, given that it sort of felt like that they were bragging. Mm-hmm. That's the word they used.
They were embarrassed.
They felt a little snotty and arrogant, or more to the point that they felt like they were might be perceived that way, and that made them very nervous.
That's I think a dynamic that I really wanted to talk with you about too. Is the way that, at least at first, right, mm-hmm. when they're doing these tours, that students were really concerned about what their school is perceived to have says about them as people.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's not just that they're going to see that my school has more resources or that my school is bigger or whatever, mm-hmm. but that means that they, mm-hmm. you know, are snotty, or that, you know, that they are, you know, look down on them, mm-hmm. or whatever it might mm-hmm. be, and that those students will then kind of purposely downplay how nice things are mm-hmm. in the school. Where you mentioned they have their radio station or they have their pool, and they'll be like, well, it's a little bit hot in this part of the class. Uh-huh. It's not that great.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to feel like they're bragging or whatever. And on the opposite side mm-hmm. of the spectrum, where the other, you know, the students at the urban school mm-hmm. are really concerned that they're going to see their school as, you know, not, they want to make sure that people know that their school isn't, you know, all bad, mm-hmm. and also that they're like, as people, like, mm-hmm. aren't all bad, and highlight the nice things and the really good parts about their school. And, you know, they talk a lot about the, you know, the culture and the art, how nice people are, how everyone greets you in the classroom. So, like, there is that, like, the sociology and the psychology part of this where you're like, man, like, yeah, like, they're both a little embarrassed, they're both a little bit defensive about their experience.
Yeah, and in some ways that, like, one of the students put it as, like, this, they felt sort of this pressure to dim down, to sort of dim down the advantages that the suburban kids had, and also, like, the city kids feeling a little bit like the need to, like, kind of dim down any of the obstacles or barriers they may be facing. And that kind of, like, it both reduced the amount of communication, sort of more genuine communication that students would have with each other. But something I also point out in the book is that I also think it tends, when we have those hesitancies, when we're worried about sharing fully, you know, what's on our mind and what we're observing, that also tends to obscure the depth of this divide, the degree of this inequality. Right. And that's in some ways one of the whole things we're trying to encourage kids to learn about. And so that it does work a little bit at cross purposes. So one of the things that we had to work on as a project was, how do we support this communication so students feel a little less reticent about sharing their own school, and also a little less reticent about how they talk about the other kids' school, because that's something they were also worried about, is they were worried that other students might feel attacked or demeaned if they shared a little bit about how much the suburban school had or what some of the barriers the Chicago students were facing.
So even if it comes from maybe a place of empathy, mm-hmm. right, of being like, I don't want these students to feel bad, or also mm-hmm. for the Taylor students mm-hmm. being like, oh, this is my family. These are my friends.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I'm not going to just sit here and talk about how terrible it all is, right?
Exactly.
It definitely makes sense why that was their first instinct.
Yeah, and like a little, I agree, like a little defensiveness about you wanting to make sure that the suburban kids know, like, we are full human beings just like you. We're going to, and sort of like wanting to, like, to defend dignity in a way. And I think this speaks to, like, how personal the students took the conditions of their own school, but also how personally they take the inequality and disparities between their school. And in some ways, I mean, having an emotional resonance with this issue, I think, can be really important, and it can help kids and adults, like, engage and participate and take action in an issue. But we also want to help students level up from those personal initial reactions and think about, this isn't on you. Whatever, right. Whatever,
and it doesn't
whatever
say
you're
about
seeing,
you.
It doesn't say anything about you, and this isn't on you. Whatever you're seeing about the other school or whatever discoveries you're making about your own school, that isn't a personal flaw. That has to do with flaws in our public educational system, flaws in our social system that have created the conditions to make these schools look this way.
And so throughout the process, they're able to be a little bit more direct with each other. I'm sure a big part of it is just that they're able to spend a lot of time together mm-hmm. purposely talking about this. Yeah. Can you talk about the evolution of it?
Yeah. So I think that being able to spend a lot of time, and we really wanted to design a project where the time was sustained when we...
Right. Because how often would they actually like see each other throughout the course of the school year?
5 or 6 times or
okay.
so, and
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and for many out like all, usually a whole day,
okay.
And then there was some contact too when they weren't in person with each other, like you know,
people made friends,
text messages,
yeah.
and social media and stuff like that. Yeah, so I think probably around 6 times during the school year, and that makes such a huge difference because when we started to design this project, I had heard of other kinds of they're normally called exchange programs that
sure.
were kind of like one shot where you would go and visit a school and then just go home.
Which I feel like could just leave you even more frustrated.
Yeah, more frustrated and potentially also lead you into, rather than understanding, perhaps assumptions because you don't have that depth. And so the amount of time really, I think, it helped them both learn more about these two schools, but definitely to learn more and form relationships with these two groups of students. And that relationship building is so important. It is so important for, I think, individuals' comfort talking across these very big divides, but it's also so important for the commitment to change, to educational change. You know, and it's important for collaboration, for the idea of collaboration. So spending a sustained amount of time really made a huge difference. And as they went back and forth between these schools, they began to be more comfortable with each other and were able to share, I think, a little more forthrightly what they were seeing and some of the disparities between their schools. And then the other major piece that we wanted to make sure to build in was that it was it's an action project. So they're not just seeing these schools just to see them, but they're seeing these schools to learn, but also to do, to take some kind of action to try to contribute in some small way to social change, to educational change. And really, that was sort of like the turning point. Once they were participating in some kind of campaign action step to try to make a difference, some of the reticence, some of the nervousness, some of the defensiveness began to fall away, and they did become sort of more direct and to the point of, listen, this is my school, this is the difference, this is what I'm seeing, this is not okay, because they were often sort of spreading that message, not just internally, but they were externalizing that message to decision makers and policymakers who could potentially make a difference.
Right. And there's a mindset shift, like for the Wyndham kids, for example, from like, you know, when they see the disparity being like, we don't deserve this nice stuff, to being like, it's not that. It's that mm-hmm. we all deserve nice
exactly.
things.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Chicago students, like, yeah. I think one of the dynamics that sometimes happens, especially if there's not enough attention to like what is causing these differences, is again that sort of personalization.
Yeah.
They may end up thinking like, I wonder if we don't have these resources because we aren't good enough students, or because someone decided that we don't try hard enough, and so that's why our school has fewer resources, and maybe that's true. So it's sort of like a process of kind of more self-blame. But once we learn about the policies and what are provided in suburban schools by default, like whether students are good students or not, they still get those resources.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think through that process, through really realizing that there are deeper social, there are deeper policy reasons for why
right.
this system looks the way it does, then it becomes, I think, easier to make that a problem of the system rather than a problem with yourself.
And there's the advocacy portion of the book,
mm-hmm.
right, which traces their work trying to make real systemic change in how public education is funded in
yeah.
Illinois. They start having conversations with lawmakers. They start meeting with elected officials. And this is a part of the book where I feel like I could really feel your frustration bleeding off the page from some of these meetings they had. Yeah. It seemed very frustrating at certain points.
Yes, sometimes that's true. And so I always have, I'm in the book a little bit just to give the reader sort of a glimpse of like both the facilitation of the project, but also because I'm in these meetings with legislators with the students, and the students are doing all the talking. But I, you know, of course, as a human being, I have reactions to some of the things that the lawmakers are saying. So part of the book, I have like, here's my own reaction and analysis to what is happening here.
So but like, why aren't they more mad?
But here's the kids, here's the kids' reaction. And that's, I think that's really interesting and in some ways kind of heartening. Like I often walked away from some of the meetings with state lawmakers feeling frustrated that I felt like the lawmakers were sort of misdirecting a little bit.
They were playing politics a little bit. They were saying a lot without saying anything.
Right. So they often would be like, oh, I think this might be a problem of priorities, like maybe your school or maybe the school district isn't prioritizing education enough. Maybe we should focus on early childhood education. The kids who are in high school are like, wait, what about us though? And then some lawmakers saying like, I don't think these school systems are actually that different. And so that sort of minimizing the disparities that the kids sort of witnessed firsthand. And so in those instances, I came away frustrated. Like, how come you're not listening to these students who have been to these schools, who have studied this policy, who are sharing, you know, some of their own anger, shock, surprise that they hadn't been able to share as much an earlier part of the project. So sometimes I came away from that with those frustrations, but frequently the students were kind of glad that the lawmakers were, in their view, sort of telling it to them straight, like, this is, you know, this is what I believe. That you could kind of, maybe they kind of appreciated when the lawmaker was just being honest. That's how they felt. And so while I expect a little bit more from politicians, there's something about that I appreciated, that the students still had a faith in, you know, in the political process, and still had faith in their own advocacy. So it didn't bum them out as much as I thought it would, and it didn't bum them out as much as it bummed me out to some degree.
And I'm sure that you got to see those students evolution as they started talking more about this. They research more about how this system works, how funding works for education, and you know, also just being more comfortable talking with elected officials, because mm-hmm. like, that just can be intimidating the first time that you do it. And the more that they do that, probably the more not only confident they are, but the sorts of questions that they're asking, that had to be a really cool thing for you to watch.
Oh, so cool. Like in one of the scenarios that is in the book, this student was like so nervous she almost didn't walk in the door.
Oh. You know, like, coax her in. Yeah.
And so I was trying to reassure her, like, the lawmaker actually asked to meet with us, you know, so they actually want to talk to you. And so she was like so nervous, but she like, especially this was one of the more supportive legislators too, who was like, I've been working on this for years. I'm so glad you showed up here. I really want to collaborate with you, and I'm going to talk about your testimony on the state Senate floor. So she was also so supportive. So I also think that made a difference. But during this conversation, I saw this student, you know, like grow more confident and want to ask follow-up questions. And even both students sort of pushing you said you're a supporter, but like in what way and how much? And so seeing these follow-ups in another meeting with a state legislator, like a student being like, telling a legislator who had just said, like, I don't really see how much can be done in this. We don't have the votes. We've tried to change school funding for many years. I know it's wrong, but this is kind of the way it was kind of like, this is the way it is, kid, And the students are not having it. It was like, the student was like, something has to be done. So what are your ideas for us? So just very like, and next step, please.
Right. There's even, I believe there's a moment too where one of the students calls the lawmaker by their first name too, which I really love too. Yeah, and it's just like, listen, give it to me straight here.
But that was interesting too, because it was a suburban student. And I think there was a little bit
there
of difference in comfort level talking to these quote unquote important people. I think the suburban kids might have had more interaction with people in this type of authority situations before, and they're also sort of getting a lot of messages, people in their community, like your voice matters,
right.
you can speak up. And it's not like city students don't get those messages as well. I just think that it's more often sort of directed at more advantaged students,
right,
that
they may be put in that position more often.
Yeah, and they feel a sense of power that kind of flows from the power their community has, and so they feel a little bit more on equal terms.
Yeah,
with a lawmaker, and so that's why, in some ways, why she called her by her first name.
I'm so glad you mentioned the suburban students and that dynamic in terms of your meetings with the lawmakers too, because there's a part of it about how you feel like some of the lawmakers maybe took you guys more seriously because these, you know, more, I guess, you know, wealthy, more privileged suburban students are there in a way that they were thinking like, well, they've got nothing to gain by, you know, the system changing. If anything, maybe they have something to lose. So like that somehow the suburban students were like coming at it more honestly or something, or that it was even somehow perceived as like selfish that the city students want to improve, you know, the funding at their school or something like that.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really fascinating dynamic that you talked about in the book.
Definitely. That, like, both lawmakers, but sometimes the students themselves also sort of portrayed the suburban students as being sort of more altruistic, as if they didn't have anything to do with this inequality. And so their participation in trying to fix it was, you know, somehow, you know, a matter of goodness or character. And I guess I was trying to argue in the book that it was a matter of goodness and character for both groups of students.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, definitely for Chicago students to really speak up and speak clearly about some of the barriers they're facing, that's a really vulnerable position to be in. And so they're also taking on a lot of risk.
And it's not just for them. It's for their community, like the whole city and people younger than them.
Yes, exactly. So they're not just looking out for themselves. They're not just being quote unquote selfish, but they're actually trying to think about like, how do we help this school so that younger students and our younger siblings and our friends and neighbors could be in a school that had more of the supports that we'd like to see. So I think that was really important to bring out. But I think the other thing I was trying to bring out there is that I do think that suburban communities also have a responsibility to try to fix this problem. I don't think it should be just on the places that are the most negatively impacted by this problem. Because one of the things I was trying to do in the book is to maybe reset our understanding of inequality, that inequality has both ends. It has an advantaged end, and it has an end where there are more barriers and obstacles. And both of those are inequality. And so that means that a whole range of our communities have direct knowledge and experience with inequality. Like advantaged students who are in suburban schools have direct experience with inequality. They're just having it on the resource-rich end.
Right, that if the scale is tipped in their favor, it's the whole scale that is inequality.
Exactly, and so that I feel like that means they are affected by it and in some ways participating in it. And so I do think that means that those communities also have a responsibility to trying to see this system fixed, this inequality erased, ideally. And then also, of course, the people who are most affected by it should be at the table and sharing their views and their experiences and how it harms them. And that should always be the case. But it is also really brave of them to do that, given the vulnerability of their position. And trying to present this model, that's what the metropolitan community is trying to speak to, that we can, as this broader community, work together and collaborate to try to work on this problem of unequal school funding.
Did the students get to go to Springfield to lobby? Because I know there was a part two, one of the politicians maybe promises that they're going to provide a bus. I don't think that ends up happening, but
right.
I thought there was a photo of them in Springfield.
Yes, yes. So they do. There was a chance to go first, and a lawmaker suggests that she's going to help pay for a bus to get us from Chicago to the state capitol, and that did not happen. That was partly got mixed up in some politics and some argument over a bill and how there was some backlash to the school funding reform. And so that promise did not get fulfilled, but we were able to go in a later time period. I think it was 3 or 4 years later that we were able to go and on a bus to Springfield in a mix of both the suburban and the city school, and they were able to advocate to their state legislators. We got a little training on how to lobby. I did not know these techniques for myself. So actually it's a little bit like stalking. You see a legislator and they're making a beeline from their offices to the Senate chamber, to the House chamber, and they walk really quickly through the lobby because they're trying not to get intercepted. And so you have to kind of pull up alongside them and then share really quickly what you're there for and try to get them to stop. And so that's what the students learned how to do. And so they would like pull up alongside them and say, like, I'm here for school funding. I want to talk. And we have...
You had like your like two lines that you had prepared.
Yeah. So that's what the students learned how to do that. And then if they got the legislator to stop, then the students would circle up around them and share their stories. Like, I'm in the Metropolitan Community Project. This is what I saw at this school. This is what my own school looked like. So they were able to offer that kind of testimony. And we'd had contact with these legislators over the years as well. And so we did hear that they were beginning to incorporate that testimony, especially the legislators who were already on board and wanted to make this reform and change, that they were incorporating some of the students' testimony into some justification for why their colleagues should jump on board with them and pass this bill.
Right. And then, you know, in your students' work did help kind of push some lawmakers into overhauling how public education is funded in Illinois. That happened in 2017 is when the actual law like went into effect and everything.
Yeah.
Did your students at the time, did that feel like a victory? Like, what were their reactions to
it? I think it was so slow, you know, like it was so slow that I'm not sure if it totally resonated, like how much of a difference it makes. Like, it takes a while to pass a bill and then, you know, of course, to put it into action and have the money start to flow. But they were super proud of, and I think this is important too, they were super proud of even just taking this step and interacting with these important lawmakers and speaking up for their positions and for their school partners. So even that was like a victory. But then, yes, of course, they are super proud that this law got passed and that there is more money flowing towards schools that need it the most. It's not enough and it hasn't closed the gap yet, but I do feel like they had a small part to play in, especially because the votes were so close in really sharing some of the emotional resonance for why this reform and change was so important.
Yeah. So like I said, like, the system has changed now, and you know, it's now what they call evidence-based funding, mm-hmm. where there is more, you know, state money that flows towards under-resourced schools and everything like mm-hmm. that. But, you know, again, you were saying even that's not a perfect system. But mm-hmm. really quick, if you could, because, you know, for people who, like I said, I think that we all maybe intuitively understand that more wealthier, you know, towns have wealthier schools, all that type of thing. And a lot of that is based on just local property taxes. But and we don't talk about this quite as much in the book, but, you know, if for a moment we could describe, like, what a more equitable system would look like, could you paint us a little picture of, like, what would be a better system? And I was thinking maybe even, like, since this project extended past when that bill went into effect, mm-hmm. maybe you guys were working more, you know, like, what would an improvement look like?
Sure. I could start with maybe the problem and then, like, how
you
fit. I think one of the problems right now is that most schools are funded through their local property taxes. So that is money raised within a school district. So if the school district has large homes and a thriving business sector, expensive land, then those school systems are able to raise a lot of money for the public schools. We, of course, do get state money and federal money as well, but those are usually smaller slices of the pie. And then in city school districts and also many rural school districts around our state, because there are not as wealthy homes, not as expensive homes, sometimes there is out of business parts of the neighborhood. And there's also, you know, museums, those are tax free. So in city school systems with a lot of those kinds of institutions. And so that means that city schools and rural school systems aren't as able to raise as much money through their local property taxes. And that often means that they are having to be more careful about the budget and budget less for these different goods and services that we know, you know, students need. So the reform and change is what's called needs-based funding. That was supposed to address two things. One is that Illinois in general was underfunding our public educational system, and so the amount that was going into our public school systems in general needed to be raised with state funds, but also that it's a different vision of equality, that we know that there are certain communities and students and places that need more, and so we would provide even more funds for school districts that are low income, or more funds for places where a lot of English learners need greater resources like bilingual teachers and translated materials. And we need more funds when there is a greater concentration of students with disabilities who need both modifications in the infrastructure of the school, but also like the kinds of services and supports that they should be provided.
Right. You talk about that as like a double whammy, right? Like mm-hmm. the students that need the most support are often in the schools that have the least.
Right, right. So a needs-based funding reform would both raise the level of funds for everyone, but also send additional funds for greater populations of low-income students, students with disabilities, and English learners. And so that was the change that got passed in the bill you mentioned in 2017, that evidence-based funding bill. One easier fix, although it's not easy, would be that promise is not being fulfilled right now, that there was supposed to be a 10-year horizon. So by 2027,
we were supposed to
be a 10-year horizon where we were supposed to, by that point, make sure that all schools had the minimum adequate and equitable funding as right. determined by this bill.
Or at least 90% of it, I think.
Right. Yeah. And that we do not have that now. It has improved, so I do want to say it did make a difference, but we are not fully funding that reform. And so as a result, students aren't receiving the full funding that was promised by that reform. But to go even further, I think that our public school systems, and this is more radical, should get off of public property taxes for funding just in general. Like I definitely think that there creates these built-in inequities where we have higher wealth communities and lower wealth communities, and they are not able to raise as much as what's needed, especially the lower income places. So if we were able to get off of property taxes and instead go towards a more state-funded school system, especially if we held the state lawmakers' feet to the fire and was like making sure that amount of money that was flowing to schools was enough and equitable and adequate, then I think that we would have a more equal school system.
Are there any places that have moved closer towards that?
There are some places like Vermont and Massachusetts have less of these disparities. It's not like they've totally gone away, sure. But there is greater state commitment, and there is either minimal or no reliance on the local sort of property taxes to raise those funds. And so I think we can use some of those states as a model to try to fix some of the imbalances we have in school funding in the state of Illinois.
I could see how that could be a difficult conversation to have, especially for people who are in those, you know, more high resourced, yeah. wealthier areas. I think especially, you know, for your position as a sociologist too, mm-hmm. like I could totally see people being like, well, yeah, I think that, you know, if we're in a, like, I'm paying more for this house, I'm paying, then maybe mm-hmm. I should have a, you mm-hmm. know, more resources, whatever. But I don't think that people would think about it from the flip perspective. I don't think that they would be like, and also I think that people in, you know, a lower income community mm-hmm. deserve a, like, worse education. I think they would think of themselves like, oh, yeah, I'm paying for it. Of course I should get more. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if they would immediately be like, I think that other kids should get less.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree. Like, if they were actually faced with the full spectrum of what the implications of that policy, that they might not fully sign on. And so I think that is true, that sometimes we end up sort of a little bit more blinkered in our reality, like only focus on our own schools and our own communities. And so I think that's one of the benefits, I think, of the Metropolitan Community Project, is it brings more of these other school districts into our frame of reference, so that we might not make such a casual statement like that, like, I don't care about, you know, other schools. So I think that is a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, I think it's so fascinating because, again, like, just reading this book, I've had so many conversations with people in my life as we all, like, reflect on our own education experiences, mm-hmm. and either, like, the resources that we did have that were great or the things that we didn't have that we wish we did.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very, you know, minor case of this, but I was thinking about how I have so I have two stepbrothers, and so they're the same age as me, but they were going to a school like two towns away that, you know, it's not like the wealthiest town in the state or anything, but definitely like had more. And there was a joke that we had that was a joke, but also was 100% true. Mm-hmm. That was at my school, one of the art classes that we offer at the high school, well, it's art 1 through 4. And I remember, like, that when I think that when my brother mentioned that they got like a 3D printer, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
My God, I can't mm-hmm. believe it. It was like, again, that's super minor mm-hmm. in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
But I think all of us have these experiences of thinking about, again, either the things that we wish we had mm-hmm. or the things that we do.
Yeah. Yeah. Like another example I'm thinking about from the book is music education.
Yeah.
Very similar to what you just said about art, that the Chicago school was able to offer beginning and advanced band, you know, that was the extent of the music offerings. And then going over to the suburban high school, and they have like opera and wind ensemble. And, you know, so this whole differentiated types of all different kinds of music for students to like engage with. And of course that makes such a big difference to students, especially if that's their passion, you know? But thinking about that idea of like some of the resistance that a more affluent community might have to changing this, like I definitely think that comes from a place, of course, of just being curious about your own and worried about what happens, you know, in your own community. But I do think that part of the thing that this partnership idea contributes to is that it doesn't have to be like a zero sum.
Yeah, that's, I think, how the thinking can be sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. That you know, that I'm going to get less if you get more.
The smile situation. I have to hoard all the resources.
Yeah.
Because if someone else gets it, I don't.
Yeah, and so one of the students even said, like, I don't want anybody's education lessened. I want the funds and resources to be lifted up for the schools that, you know, that need it. And perhaps thinking about it that way and can be helpful, but I think our natural reaction is only to think about our own schools and our own communities unless we have these connections, you know, with the broader community. I think the other thing is that this is a public school system, so it's not supposed to work like I paid for this and so then I get those services. That sounds like a private school system to me. So like instead it should be, you know, these are opportunities that we've committed to as a state or as a country that we're going to provide all students. It shouldn't be like I paid for this and this is what I get out of it, at least in my own personal perspective.
And obviously you hope that more of these, you know, cross-community partnerships happen. Have any of them, like, have you heard of any more that have come out of the work that you guys did there? Or, like, do you think it is something that is maybe happening more now?
I actually don't know, and that's actually one reason why I wrote the book.
Oh,
is
really?
Because what I really wanted to do is, like, try to share a little bit about this model and what students got out of it and what we were able to accomplish sort of politically and policy level so that other school systems might be able to, you know, replicate this model. So I really wrote the book for teachers and administrators because I'm hoping it provides a little inspiration. Of course, I can also assist with that to try to think about, like, how can we replicate this model and add to this model, improve on this model so that we would have more cross-district collaborations and more schools and districts talking to each other and more groups of students getting to know each other. Yeah.
And, you know, it's great. At the end of the book, there are definitely some students who are like, even after I'm done with the Metro project, like I want to keep this fight going. Like mm-hmm. I want to keep stay involved and do education equity work. Mm-hmm. I was curious if you've been able to stay in touch with any students or kind of seen it in whatever way that could look like. It could take a lot of different forms.
Yeah.
But how that work maybe has continued.
Yeah. With a few, like I do. There's some of the students in the book say that they want to be teachers and they did become teachers.
Oh,
so that's really, I think that's so exciting. And they're also the students I'm thinking of are also like super, super committed. And so I think they're sort of thinking about it like, you know, I'm going to invest in this classroom and in giving students the best quality education. And that's going to be my form of contribution to this larger issue. But some of the students are also, they're also teaching about subjects like this, like in a social studies or English class, so that more younger students can also start thinking about like, how do I understand the world around me? And also how can I get involved, you know, in the world around me. So that's really exciting.
The last question I had for you,
yes,
is just, I know you've been doing this type of youth activism work for a long time, mm-hmm. and writing about youth advocacy and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to see if you'd talk just again a little bit about the importance of giving students the tools and the time mm-hmm. to engage with big issues and engage with their community and their state in the way that you guys were able to.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think making sure that they have like a platform to be able to express how they're feeling about their schools and their school resources is so important, because as adults and adult educators, we often miss things. And it's sometimes the case that the priority students have or the things that are most bugging them about the schools are not necessarily things on our radar. Like we might be thinking about, like, how do I teach the best lesson, or, you know, how do I make sure that there's the most advanced curriculum offered to students, and they get worried about things like the bathrooms,
right, the bathroom's
and,
not
and
clean,
their food,
yeah.
You know, and we might think that that feels minor to us, but if that's weighing on their minds, then some of the other things that we also care about as educators may not be, you know, as successful as we'd like them to be. So I really like the idea of thinking through with students, like, what bugs you about your school? What do you love about your school? How can we, you know, strengthen the
right.
latter and reduce the former? So I think that's so important. But also, like, they know so much. They have this really deep knowledge about what it is like to be a student in this school
every day. Every day. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. They know so much. So I want to like honor that expertise and that knowledge. But also, if we are thinking about how we change these school systems, then I think working with and finding avenues and pathways for them to get involved in these discussions, get involved in the kinds of changes that adult policymakers and educators are talking about is really important, that they should be considered partners in this work because of their expertise, because of their passion, and also because of their impatience. Like in some ways, like sometimes like when teenagers or younger students are impatient, or, you know, we kind of want that to change, but that's also a resource. They are so impatient with how the system is working now.
Because they're going to be gone in 4 years, right?
Yeah, and they want this fixed, you know, now. And they're so flabbergasted, like, once they find out how schools are funded based on, like, mostly what a local community is able to pay. They're so flabbergasted that would be how we've set up our public school system. So I think that impatience can be an asset and a resource. Because we want people to be passionate, and it really takes that kind of passion to see these kinds of really difficult changes through. You know, it's a long haul process. You know, the change for EBF funding that took. Evidence-based funding that took 4 years for that law to get passed from the time it was introduced to the time it actually, you know, got signed into law. And so we need people who have passion and impatience for the system and how it works now, and to get them involved, and to also make them feel like they are full citizens. Some of them might not be able to vote yet, but they are full members of this community, just like adults and parents and teachers and administrators are. And so that's really honoring that piece of their commitment and their role, the role that they have to play in improving this educational system. So I do think just like calling on students' energy and impatience and knowledge is going to be crucial for us to change this school system.
Cynthia, that was it. I really hope that you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did.
Oh, I enjoyed it so much. I'm really passionate about this, and I'm so happy to share what our students have worked on and accomplished after all these years. And also, I wanted to say that I am here as a resource in order to help if any other teachers and administrators are thinking about wanting to work on a partnership between their school districts to work on any kind of educational issue that students decide on.
That was Cynthia Taines. She's an associate professor at Northern Illinois University in the College of Education. And Cynthia is also the author of The Metropolitan Community, Partnering for Equality Across the Educational Divide, which is out right now. A big thank you to everyone for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. Send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing the podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating, share with a friend. It's just the best way to get even more perspectives on the show and reach more people. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of our show. And I have been your host, Peter Medlin. This is Teacher's Lounge.